Thank you. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, let's see, if this is a Saturday, this must be Los Angeles. I came in on the red eye overnight from Honolulu, having spoken to the Republican Western States Leadership Conference at the Maui Intercontinental yesterday morning, and then flown over from Kahului to Honolulu and picked up United Airlines overnighter to Los Angeles. And if I get confused, that's the reason. In the interest of time, I'm going to omit the usual 15-minute tribute to Philadelphia and say a word instead, a kind word for the young man who drew the short straw at the Claremont Institute and had to meet me at the airport at 5:15 this morning. Chris Buskirk, are you around? There he is, back there. Bless his heart. I could also recognize everybody else here, because I know everybody else here. These things become this is your life after a while. If I start out by hailing this one or that one, my speech time will be over by the time I get through hailing, but you know who you are. At the Republican Western States Leadership Conference, which is an official organization of the Republican Party, the state chairman and Republican National Committee men and committee women and regional political directors of the Republican National Committee for the Western States, plus assorted outriders, I spoke to them on basically the same topic that I want to talk with you about now, the next conservative agenda. You have to do it a little bit differently with politicians. I had to explain to them, or thought I'd better be careful and explain to them, that the conservative movement is the wine and the Republican Party is the bottle. I have to tell you that they took that pretty well. Because I explained that you can't go anywhere with a wine unless you put it in a bottle, and a bottle isn't much use unless it's got some wine in it. In the case of the Democratic Party, that bottle has been full of liberalism, to put it charitably, for many years, and for 30 years, or at least since 1964, make that 27, the Republican Party has had in the bottle conservatism. It has not worked all that badly. Prior to the Goldwater year, the Republican Party, during all the time I can remember thinking about it, and that goes back a while, had been losing with cheerful consistency, except for Eisenhower, a very popular general, with about 40% of the vote, give or take. 40% of the American people are economic conservatives. They believe in balancing the budget, keeping taxes low, that kind of thing. And that'll get you 40% of the vote. But as we discovered, it will not get you 50% of the vote, which in a democracy is what you need. The Democrats had the other 60, give or take again. And the way I figure, about 40% of those are people who, in one way or another, are on the take from the federal government. You're not going to get them away from the Democratic Party. They think that the Democratic Party is good for them, and it is. And it keeps on increasing their checks, and they will keep on voting in return for it. But there turned out to be a movable 20%. And in about the middle of the 1960s, when the riots began to impact heavily, and the Vietnam War resistance rose, and the drug culture suddenly inundated the country, and the tide of pornography rose, and the sexual revolution was kicked off, it turned out that about 20% of the American people who had been voting Democratic were prepared to say, we're not as concerned about the being on the side of the little guy against the big one economically as we are concerned about being on the side of the family against all the forces attacking it in modern America. And as you know, because I'm preaching here to the converted, that 20%, the social conservatives, as they came to be known, proceeded to move first, a lot of them, not all of them, to Wallace, but then after 1968, but after he was shot out of the race in 1972, and the Democrats nominated yet another pure-blooded liberal, Senator McGovern, even Richard Nixon, by simply identifying himself with both the economic and conservative aspects of conservatism, economic and social aspects of conservatism, proceeded to win with every state but Massachusetts in 1972. The subsequent election of Jimmy Carter doesn't prove anything to the contrary. It was very narrow to begin with. It was right after Watergate, for a second thing. And in the third place, Jimmy Carter ran, those of you who are old enough can remember, as a born-again Christian on an anti-Washington platform. He was as near as in the Democratic Party you could get at that time to an anti-liberal in his general societal attitudes. And so he squeaked in against Gerald Ford, who didn't really have a clue as to what composed the Republican Party and had thought that his shrewdest move was making Nelson Rockefeller his vice president. An idea so bad that he had to drop it and get Rockefeller off the ticket before he could even secure his own nomination in 1976. But then came a man who understood the situation perfectly well and who identified personally with both the economic and conservative aspects of the economic and social aspects of the conservative movement. And Ronald Reagan won in 1980 heavily and then was reelected, as we know, again, with just a single state holding out, Minnesota. And George Bush has benefited by the same coalition. All this I said yesterday rather carefully to the Republicans, lest some of them didn't know it, but I was very encouraged when I had run through that little liturgy and concluded that it is our sacred obligation to hang on to that coalition of social and economic conservatives. There was a round of applause. Now, from a conservative audience, that wouldn't be so surprising. From a Republican audience, and these were national committeemen and committeewomen and state chairmen and political directors of the National Committee, to hear that round of applause was not only gratifying, but to me, surprising. I didn't know that so many people now got the point of that coalition, and the good news is I think that they at least do. I will admit that this particular conference, the area, is quite conservative in general. Even so, it was, I thought, extremely encouraging to see. But now, the coalition has some questions to answer, it seems to me. We stand at a, as you know, at an absolutely remarkable point in human history. The whole, to put it philosophically, the whole 200-year era of Western man after the Enlightenment and the French Revolution, the idea that scientific rationalism could lead the way for mankind, that as Nietzsche said, God was dead and we would work out our own destiny hereafter. The idea that spawned, on the one hand, Marxism and Leninism, and on the other hand, the dilute forms of democratic socialism that we have had in the West, and of liberalism, as they call it, in the United States. That whole notion of how to run the affairs of mankind has come a terrible cropper. It has just plain collapsed in its highest epiphany in the Soviet Union. It is being rejected in Sweden, even in the West, not to mention the United States. The whole concept of the free market, as distinguished from dirigiste forms of government to determine economic policy, has become the common currency of the world, the thinking world. And the still more deadly, because more imminent and more dangerous, threat of world conquest by communism has simply ended. So it turns out that we conservatives were right on the main issues that have affected and afflicted the 20th century. And everybody pretty much knows it. Here and there, somebody tries to deny it or tries to toss the credit to somewhere else. But basically, it was the conservative analysis of society that has conquered. And the question therefore arises, what next? Because it is, of course, written in the nature of things that every triumph, every success gives rise to a new challenge which must be met. And actually, too, not to overdo our triumph. And by the way, let me say, I'm well aware. Better put this in, because there are people who are temperamentally gloomier than I am. I know very well that everything is not perfect in, let's say, you know, the Bush administration. The cost of government continues to rise, and here and there are all these dreadful things that we have to fight day by day, but we're fighting them insofar as politics admits of victory. And Richard Nixon once said very shrewdly, no political victory is ever complete. But insofar as it can be, this has been a victory for conservatism. But still the question arises, what next? And if conservatism, as I believe, is a thoroughgoing analysis of the nature of man and of his relation to society and of the way in which we can best go forward, if that is true, then we must, borrow Lincoln's phrase, think anew and act anew, because the old solutions won't lead us any further, I think, than they have. They have done everything that they can do. Now then comes the hard part. And I am not at all surprised to see that some extremely leading conservatives have begun talking and thinking about that. The direction in which they are talking and thinking was pointed out, interestingly enough, by a man who is not generally one of us, and that is Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who said not long ago, the central conservative truth is that it is culture, not politics, that determines the success of a society. The liberals have always imagined that if you just passed enough laws and filled out the gaps with enough regulations and enough goodwill and added enough money, almost all the problems of society could be solved. We know better. We know that you have to cut deeper than that. The most wonderful paragraph, I think, in Richard Weaver's Ideas Have Consequences comes right at the very beginning, the first paragraph. And I don't, unfortunately, have the quote with me, but I can paraphrase it. He says, in the mind of any thinking person, there are three levels. His convictions having to do with certain topical issues of the day, and then below that, his deep beliefs on a few profound ideas, and then at bottom, his metaphysical view of the world. I think that is true, and I mention it because what we, I think, are going to have to do is not simply worry about the little topical issues of the day. They must still concern us, of course, but not that alone. I think we have to address the deep convictions of the American people on a few important things, things that do not change, things that that govern and dominate issues. I think conservatives have always believed in that. I think it's a part of our conviction that you can't just pass laws and have the successful consequences. But now we are going to have to start operating at that deeper level. And what does that consist of? Moynihan mentioned it as culture, not politics. What was he talking about? Margaret Thatcher, in a wonderful address in Washington to the Heritage Foundation recently, and by the way, you may have noticed that it was covered nowhere in the United States except in the Washington Post style section, which reported what she wore. Margaret Thatcher has touched on it, and I'll just read three sentences of that speech. She says, "The life of free men and women has to be a life of self-discipline, self-control, and for family and country, self-sacrifice. There will always be new or retread socialists anxious to persuade our peoples that wealth can be redistributed before it is generated and that ease can be purchased without effort. So we conservatives must preach the hard truths and not just the more comforting half-truths about the free political and economic system which we value." Now, I do not have an orderly platform of where we go from here. I'm working on it. A year, 2 years from now, my speech will be more specific. But let me just point the direction. I think, for one thing, without in any way adopting all of the agenda of Paul Weyrich's cultural conservatism, that he is absolutely right, as Moynihan indicates, that the battle has to be fought at the cultural level. That is to say, Weyrich would say it doesn't do a bit of good to win legislatively or judicially the abortion argument. You simply have to cut altogether deeper. You have to convince the people that the whole idea is wrong, and then you will be winning automatically the battles of legislation and judicial determination. And so with drugs. We can attack the supply, but until we have not only attacked the demand, but somehow resurrected a society capable of resisting drugs to at least the necessary extent, we are not going to win that battle. And similarly, with the sexual revolution and the all the other disturbances of our age, the attack on the family. These are very large orders, of course. They are going to occupy us during most of the 21st century. They are probably harder battles to win than the ones we have already won in favor of free enterprise and political democracy, because at least free enterprise sort of demonstrates its own success. If you fight it long enough, you fall flat on your face, as the communists discovered. In this particular case, it's true, too, that a society that does not exercise the kind of self-discipline and self-control and self-sacrifice that Margaret Thatcher talked about will eventually fall flat on its face, too. But we must argue against that happening. We must be the ones to lead people. And I encourage you not to be discouraged about the possibility of leading people in this regard. You may have seen these polls that Gallup and other organizations take all the time, in which they ask people, do you think that America has gotten off on the wrong track? About 75% of the American people say yes. And the Democrats, these poor souls, leap on this and say, you see, 75% of the American people are against Bush. Nothing could be further from the truth. The American people don't understand that question as a question about Bush or about parties. They think it's a philosophical question, and it is a philosophical question. Their answer is overwhelmingly yes, we have gotten off on the wrong track. And believe me, my friends, if we can convince them that conservatism knows that and wants to put them back on the right track, and if it remains the wine in the bottle of the Republican Party, we can win far more victories in the 21st century than we have ever won in the 20th. because they believe it, they want, in their great majority, it's not everybody, of course, to go that way. I read at an ISI function in Boulder at the University of Colorado recently, a well-known quotation from de Tocqueville, but one that always warrants rereading and which you may not be familiar with because it puts its finger precisely on this point. He said, "I sought for the greatness and genius of America in her commodious harbors and ample rivers, and it was not there. In her fertile lands and boundless prairies, and it was not there. Not until I went to the churches of America and heard her pulpits aflame with righteousness did I understand the secret of her genius and power. America is great because she is good. And if America ceases to be good, America will cease to be great." I do not intend to scatter sawdust on the floor here and invite you all to a revival meeting, because every century, you know, deals with these deep problems in its own way and in its own vocabulary and in its own mindset. And the 21st century's way of dealing with this problem, of whatever it is predictably going to be different than that of the 20th or the 19th century. But there, it seems to me, somewhere is the direction in which we, America, must go and where conservatism must lead us. To take the only issue that comes readily to mind, I have no question at all that abortion is one tip of the iceberg of the great controversy that we're talking about here. But we must be sensible about this. We must be not merely didactic. I very much like the way Ronald Reagan handled that and the way Bush has handled it. And I'll tell you why. They understood that when you talk about abortion, or indeed most of the social conservative issues, they are profound issues affecting the very warp and woof of the society. And you do not zip a bill or even a constitutional amendment through Congress the first time around on that and solve that problem. No, no. Ronald Reagan took exactly the right position with regard to the issue, and then stood there and represented it. He understood that one of the roles of an American president is to be, as somebody has said, the Pontifex Maximus of the American civil religion. His job was to stand for what was right and let the political process over the years and over the decades work, and I think it is working, in that direction on that issue. And Bush has done the same thing, stood firm for the issue, but not attempted to crunch people against their will before they are ready, before they have thought it through, into solutions that are not useful to them. Now, I happen to think that the answer, or at least the temporary answer, to the abortion problem is to get it out of the hands of the Supreme Court and back into the hands of the states, where you will certainly win a lot of the battles immediately and can then fight the others as long and as hard as it takes. So things are moving in the right direction. And that, I think, is going to be true of a great many of the other issues of social policy that face us in the years ahead. From time to time, when I get discouraged with the American society, I think, well, maybe it isn't going to be our job anyway. I'm very interested to see, you know, that great westward push of human history. I can't help thinking that the Oriental nations have been saved by God for some purpose. They did not play the great role. It was the West that led mankind as far as it has gotten so far. But the Orientals aren't out there for nothing, and they have great perception and great stake as we do in the outcome. It may be, I have sometimes thought, that the ultimate job will be theirs. But then again, I think, no, America, and you see it every time you turn around, America is still the leader. Have you heard the statistic? I couldn't prove this if I had to, but I heard it asserted for real, and it's remarkable, and I think it's true. More Americans go to church on any average Sunday than attend all professional sports events in a year. I don't think that's implausible. And, of course, you don't hear about it for the same reason that the New York Times excludes all religious books from its bestseller list. It doesn't count the way they count. I think the American people, provided they are talked to sensibly, provided we understand the depth and length and duration of the problem, are ready to be led in this direction, and I wouldn't even, and didn't, accept the idea that the Republican Party, which necessarily has to have its mind on winning every 2 or 4 years, couldn't afford to get into this battle. I think it can, and I think it should, and I think ultimately it will. So I am an optimist over the long haul. Those of you who have heard me before know what's coming next and last, because I always end my speeches with it, or almost always. My favorite little quatrain from the 19th century British poet Coventry Patmore, because I find it encouraging and reassuring, and I'm sure you will. For want of me, the world's course will not fail. When all its work is done, the lie shall rot. The truth is great and shall prevail. When none cares whether it prevail or not.